The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello? My name is Richard Simmons. Not the famous Richard Simmons. I'm Richard Simmons, the Hunchback. Master said that I'm going to play a recording from the answering machine for Master's show. So, okay.
Okay.
This is the Chris Keeper. Go fuck yourself! No, seriously. Leave your name and number and I'll get right back to you. I don't know. I thought that... Hello? Hello? Richard Simmons? Are you home? Richard Simmons, pick up. Pick up the phone, Richard Simmons. Okay, Richard Simmons, listen to me very closely. It's the master. I'm going to make a recording. You are to record it and give it to DiMonzo. He'll put it on the podcast. I don't know. Okay? Okay, so here we go. Hello, horror fiends. It's the Chris Keeper here. Apparently, the kidnapping Christian Bale and accidentally killing him and throwing him in a dumpster was not such a good idea, and I am in jail right now. Which is kind of ironic, because this month's movie is Assault on Precinct 13. Which has a happy ending, because... Well, they end up leaving jail anyway. But I'm going to talk to my lawyer, and hopefully I'll be back next time with another...
Hey, Skeletor, what you doing?
Okay, another episode...
Hey, get off the phone and get over
okay,
here,
Okay, I gotta go.
Hello and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. Take whatever it was to get that right every month. And I'm here with Luke Giaconetti. And once again, we are joined by the hair metal hero back from his latest succubus adventure.
Hopefully. Oh, yeah.
Hey, how'd you ever get the name the hair metal hero anyway?
How did I come up with that name? Let's see. I like hair metal. I like metal. I like superheroes. Peanut butter, jelly, swish them together. It's about as simple as that.
See, we're going to say you would tell me sometime.
That was what?
I thought you were going to say, oh, I'll tell you sometime. And then I'd say, oh, about 8 seconds.
It was a setup, sorry. Man. It was a setup.
I'm not exactly a peak performance right now. No.
You're not drunk enough?
No, I got a sinus infection.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear.
Oh, well.
So let's talk about little girls getting shot.
Yeah. You don't see that every day.
No, you don't.
And I thought that was a big deal in the premiere of The Walking Dead that they blasted a little girl. But this was actually a real live little girl in her little dress with her ice cream and her pigtails. And this was like... a Brady girl. It was like Cindy Brady off with Mr. Roper from Three's Company.
You know what's amazing is the MPAA they threatened Carpenter with an X rating if that scene wasn't cut. And Carpenter in his deviousness, the copy that he sent to the MPAA for review had the scene cut. And then he simply sent to all the film distributors a young cut movie.
And he probably got away with it, too.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah. That's yeah, that's one of the great rules of you know, do something and apologize for it later. Whoops, sorry about that. Did that cut get through?
Always better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Well, I just wanted to say you sort of picked out the order of the remaining Carpenter films, and I thought this was a perfect follow up to Escape from New York.
And you know what's funny is that I hadn't seen Assault in several years, and so watching it again obviously was a real treat. But as I watched it, I thought, you know, maybe we should have watched this one first, because there's so many elements that would show up in Escape from New York and Escape from L.A. that have their genesis here in Assault on Precinct 13.
It's
almost like this is the prototype.
That's, you know? That's the exact word that I have written in my notes is prototype. It's like the, you know, a lot of, it was funny when I was reading about this movie, a lot of people call it John Carpenter's first movie, but that's, you know, that was Dark Star. But this is like his first fully formed John Carpenter movie. This has like all the, you know, elements that would become his trademarks, and they're all there and they're all working exactly almost as they will in the future. That's why I sort of liked watching it after Escape from New York, because I picked up on a lot of that stuff. You know, I mean, the convict on death row in here is basically Snake Plissken, right down to the smoke cigarette cravings, you know, throughout the whole movie, the running gag, and the woman who finally fulfills his wish.
Oh yeah. Oh, she's just a dirty, dirty whore.
The look that he gives her, that they give each other when he asks her if she has a smoke, and she starts reaching for it, and you can see the look on his face. It's just priceless. That is a great scene.
Well, you know, and I like that. Besides the smoking running gag, there's also the running gag I was setting up with the hero about Napoleon's name. And it's like that gag gets recycled, you know, with call me snake. You know, it's a name gag. It's recycled almost, you know, verbatim.
Yep. What's my name? Give me a smoke.
Yeah.
and geez, I mean, the gang leader, the young gang leader, I mean, is Cuervo Jones. I mean, basically, yeah. Che Guevara, but I mean, you know, he's got the same outfit as Cuervo Jones.
Yeah. And you know, it's, you know, it's like I said, it's very much a prototype of the type of the way that Carpenter would make action films for the rest of his career. And so watching it, it's like seeing everything at its genesis state.
Yeah. The only thing that isn't consistent is the font on the credits. He didn't have his font down at this point.
I mean, the credit style is the same. You know, the black background with just plain text, and then his music. But you're right. I noticed that it's not white and it's not the right font.
It's just sort of a bland sort of font. He hadn't got his font on yet. But otherwise, I mean. At first, I was like, you know, this isn't really a horror movie. But as it went on, I was like, this is a horror. This is basically Night of the Living Dead. It's almost a reimagining of Night of the Living Dead.
And his favorite movie of all time, Rio Bravo.
Yeah.
Right. And so, which again brings us back to Howard Hawks,
mm-hmm.
which we come back to time and again on this show. And actually, what's very funny is that I'm in the Greenville, South Carolina television market, and we have a station here that has the retro TV syndication package. And on Saturday nights at 10 o'clock, they show Wolfman Max Drive-In Theater. Fair enough. What was on last night? But Night of the Living Dead. So I watched Assault on Precinct 13, and I'm flipping around. It's like, hey, Night of the Living Dead. It's like there's a grand irony right there.
Yeah. I mean, right down to the like, you know, the black protagonist who takes charge, you know, and a panicky woman, and I also noticed the gang members. I don't think they don't have a single line of dialogue,
except when they declare the cholo.
Did they say something then? I thought they just tossed it down on the ground.
No, not. At the very beginning, when they're cutting, they're putting the blood into the chalice.
Uh huh.
They all say Cholo as they pass it around. That's the only they have. And you're right. That is Carpenter has said that's and has acknowledged that's a direct Night of the Living Dead influence on the gang, that they're not presented as humans at all. They're not given any humanizing traits. So for all intents and purposes, they are very much the same as the ghouls from Night of the Living Dead. They're just the force outside trying to get their way in.
Yeah, well, once they explain what the Cholo is and that they don't care and that they'll die, however, then they're basically just declaring themselves zombies at that point. They're just going to come in the windows and, you know, they're just neat zombies. They clean up their dead when they're done.
Those are very budget-conscious zombies. If you don't need dead bodies lying around, that's one less extra you got to pay, too.
Right. Now, here's something one of you guys might know. Do either of you guys know what KFU is?
What's that?
KFU. I noticed KFU was scrawled in graffiti on one of the jail cells and on the ground on the sidewalk outside during one of the scenes. You see, like, somebody is, like, written KFU on both of them. I have no idea what it is.
You know, I'm not sure, but I wonder if that has... Because I know a lot of the extras and a lot of the gang members were film students at USC.
Uh huh.
So maybe that means something at University of Southern California.
Yeah, I did like a couple Google searches and it didn't come up. I'm thinking, is it like the only thing that came the only KFU that came out was Kentucky Fried Chicken University, and I don't think that's what he was talking about in this movie.
That'd be pretty awesome.
Well, you know, maybe that's where he got some of his financial backing for this movie. And
I was going to say, it's interesting because the financial backing is why the movie is titled the way it is. Because the original title of this film, and a title I think is very appropriate, is called The Anderson Alamo. And after they shot it, they changed the name to The Siege, but then it was the CKK Corporation, who was the financial backing. They titled it Assault on Precinct 13 because they thought it sounded more ominous.
More what?
Ominous.
Oh yeah. Well,
even though, you know, there is no Precinct 13 in the movie.
That's true. Well, they say, like, Precinct something Station 13.
Yeah, Precinct 9 Station 13. Yeah. But I guess some Precinct 9 doesn't sound as cool.
Yeah, 13 is just, bad luck. But it's really funny because this movie gets described, I think, a lot as sort of just a awesome B-movie, you know, action movie, you know, no-frills action movie. But as I was watching it, man, there's a lot of, for an exploitation movie, there's some beautiful cinematography in it. There's a lot of care in it. And really, I'd forgotten since it's been so long since I've seen it, this movie takes its sweet time introducing the characters and setting everything up and just building the tension that... I think this movie deserves a lot more props than it gets. The lighting, the cinematography, just the feel for the slums of LA is really kind of unique in this movie.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me of besides the obvious connections we've already talked about, and this kind of gets back again to the last episode. It kind of reminds me of what we would get several years later with Death Wish. That kind of, again, with that urban hell, kind of early beginnings of the ultra-violence movement. You know, just the complete lack the unblinking eye aspect of the camera, you know.
Yeah.
Seeing the, much like we see the young girl gunned down, and in all its glory, and then a couple of years later, you know, I guess in Death Wish, we're seeing the wife and daughter attacked and raped. And it's that same idea. You know, it's the unblinking look at the violence of the depraved and the criminal, and then turning that around to the heroic characters that have to bring justice to them. And there's a very much a kind of late 70s attitude, I think, that both of these films really have in spades.
Yeah. And it's weird because they set up with the father and the daughter, they kind of set it up like the father might be in some kind of trouble. Because there's the one scene where she's like, oh, maybe you can ask those cops there. And he was just like, oh, no. and keeps going. So you're thinking, okay, maybe this guy's kidnapping his daughter or something. And, it's all set up, but then it's all just sort of abandoned, you know. Then he just becomes, you know, just as his character is basically, once he gets to the police station, he's just like a lump of meat. Literally, he just collapses in a corner and goes down, and you never find out what the backstory was or how it resolves or any of that. I kind of like that. That was something very, very common in gritty movies of the 70s. And nowadays, it seems like writers of movies feel they have to tie everything up. You know, there would have been more to this guy's story. I have to watch the remake again. Although I realized that the remake and this one were, you know, almost two completely different movies, you know, with two sets of different characters.
Yeah. But, and what's interesting about Lawson, the father, is he kind of reminds me in a tangential way of Barbara from Night of the Living
Dead. Yeah.
You know, we're introduced to Barbara at the very beginning, and she's the pretty young blonde girl. You know, conventional wisdom says, oh, she'll be our heroine. But after her brother is killed, she makes it to the house. Barbara's catatonic for the majority of the film.
Yep.
And, you know, she's not the damsel in distress that we're acculturated to believing the pretty blonde girl is going to be. And much in the same way Lawson, we figure, oh, well, he's going to be one of the heroes. You know, because he took revenge for killing his daughter, and now they're gonna, you know, now the station's under siege. He's gonna be one of the guns, and he's like, nope. Like you say, he's just a lump of meat.
Yep, he just is the one who kicks off the action, and that's all that's necessary. Because once the action's kicked off, it goes until it's done, and then it's done. And very very 70s, although. A lot of the main character, you know, three of the main characters walked out of this alive. So that's pretty good for usually that time period. Usually like Night of the Living Dead, nobody lived, you know? So it may be a kind of, was, you know, people were sort of expecting maybe a darker, what I wondered is why they didn't just go into that sewer drain and keep going. Like they were afraid the first guy was going to do. Why didn't they all just do that? Just leave. Let him burn up the precinct.
Now, Chris, you're not supposed to ask questions like that.
That there were only two of those. It was that, and there was nobody found the ice cream man and the little girl's body by the side of the road, and there weren't like cops going nuts, you know, in that whole area. I mean, it was definitely within running distance of the precinct, so you'd think there would have been cops scouring the area.
At least that one, you could rationalize that, oh, they hid the bodies just like they did all the other bodies.
Yeah.
I mean, you could at least, I mean, again, you could rationalize it. I agree with you. That does kind of constitute a plot hole. But, you know, but as far as three, the two heroes and the girl surviving, I think that gets back to the other influence. That gets back to the Howard Hawks Western. You know, it's like in a Western, especially before we got into like the Wild Bunch and things of that nature, when kind of getting back to the old fashioned sort of Western, you know, usually the heroes survived the day.
Yes.
You know, they withstood and stood against the challenge and rode off into the sunset. And that's kind of like what we have here, you know, with Lee, who, you know, so we have a stretcher for you, miss, and she very defiantly, you know, walks out herself, which I really liked that. I always have liked that. I thought that was a very nice touch that could have been just as easily forgotten about.
Now, she's not the same actress from They Live, is she? She looks very similar, but she doesn't have the eyes, you know?
I mean, look. No.
It's just John Carpenter's type.
Although the other secretary, Julie, is played by Nancy Loomis, who would go on to play Annie Brackett in Halloween. Because as we've long established, Carpenter only works with about 24 people and just mixes them around as need be.
And oh my God, I love the marshal who is transporting him. You know, he's that perfect character. As soon as you see him, he's chewing gum. It's just the great standard, you know, wise out, nom, 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 he's chewing his gum. Just classic everything. It's just fitting into the classic prototypical, you know, you can see all the foundation laid for Halloween and for Escape from New York right in this movie. I like the music. This is some of my favorite John Carpenter music too. It's really, really good. It's even more sort of goblin-y than usual.
Yeah, it has definitely a rock edge to it, which sometimes we would get, like Escape from New York has more of a sort of prog sound to it. This definitely was a rock soundtrack. And that's a good connection with Fabio Fritzi and goblin style kind of pulsing rock soundtrack. And this type of score is, you know, not really common here in the U.S., but very common, especially in Italian action cinema, German action cinema, that type of a genre film. So it may actually help describe one of the reasons why this film was kind of, you know, a fire and forget in the U.S., but actually became a pretty big commercial and critical success in Europe. And, you know, the idea being that, you know, all the Western elements, because as American filmgoers, we're so ingrained in the Western that we don't even give it a second thought, you know?
Right.
Whereas European viewers, you know, who were more, you know, the American Western was still a novelty, you know, witnessed the spaghetti Westerns and all that. They caught on to the Western aspects and latched onto that and enjoyed it on that level, too. So that may, you know, address that a little bit, you know. It's hard to say why Europe likes anything, in my opinion, but...
Yeah.
I mean, they like Hasselhoff, so...
That's what I was just going to say. Hasselhoff, just like, yeah, it says it all.
Hey, Looking for Freedom is a great song.
I was just, there was just some sort of, like, Euro Music Awards, and I was reading a news story about it that some huge, you know, mega big deal. It's been literally going on for 3 years, like, this contest. And, like, the band that won literally had, like, the Russian government behind it to, like, promoting it and stuff. And it was just hilarious because they were talking, you know, the Russian government's investing in this band because they know if this band wins this, that it'll actually be big money for Russia and their pop industry and stuff like that. Really bizarre. And it's something that we'll never hear of, really, except as a sort of news story. Then I heard the song, and it was the most terrible, vacuous, you know, techno, weird. It was just awful, awful, you know, just as bad as you would expect Euro pop to be. So, yeah, I don't know what's in the water over there or in the atmosphere or whatever, but... Yeah, sometimes I don't know. But whatever it is, it makes them like our stuff a lot. For some reason. And then they get their hands on it and do all sorts of weird things, which often turns out being really fun.
Well, you know, it's the same as something that I enjoy pointing out to people is that, you know, especially with kind of the generation younger than Hiro and I, really in this country there's a lot of Asiophiles, you know, folks that love anything that comes from Japan or Korea.
Yes.
Mostly just comes from Japan or Korea. Well, what they don't realize is that their opposite numbers in Japan love American crap.
Right, right.
The fashion, it's not so prevalent anymore, but the fashion for a long time for, you know, teen and young teen girls in Japan was to bleach your hair, you know, wear the big platform shoes, get, you know, the Wonder Bras and everything, trying to look American. You know?
And, no, there's and nothing hotter than an Oriental woman trying to look American.
I wondered if you were still here.
Oh, I'm still here. That's
not right.
What? Where?
I said, especially if they got the jade green eyes, right?
Oh yeah.
Chinese girls do not come with green eyes.
I don't care if they come at all, as long as I do.
Oh. No.
Put the kids to bed. This is a blue show, folks.
Yeah, the kids shouldn't be listening to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror.
They shouldn't be watching Sound Precinct 13 either, so.
Yeah, it's funny, I had this conversation with Scott the other day. If they were my kids, they would be. I was telling Scott, I know people who show, well, they're not little kids anymore, but they were little kids when they first, that would show them the most horrifying, you know, gory horror movies, and it's all context. They taught their kid, you know, I think they pretty much prefaced showing their kids horror movies by making their kids interested in how the makeup was done. So when people were getting their heads taken off, the kids were like, "Oh!" And it didn't help. It didn't hurt that dad did prosthetic stuff too. So when they saw like Jason taking someone's head off, they were looking at it more like the stuff that goes on in dad's workshop than somebody actually getting their heads cut off. And I remember like sitting in horror. I can't remember what we were watching, but it was something. You know, it was basically some sort of trauma, like gore fest. And I was watching it with like a 6 and 7 year old kid. And at first I was like, oh God, you know, am I going to sit here and get to see these kids traumatized? But, oh my God, they were having a riot. If I was that age, but when all the stuff I saw that traumatized me, I saw it alone. So I was just sitting quivering in front of the TV set. So, yeah. But, oh my God, if I had kids, they would swear so much, it would be ridiculous. I would teach them the most insane combinations of cuss words. You wouldn't believe it.
Oh, if I ever have a son, he'll be kicked out of school in the second grade for sexual harassment. I'm positive.
Yeah, sounds like you and I are homeschoolers.
Yeah. I think I'll pass on the homeschooling and go right to the vasectomy, and I don't even have to worry at all.
Eliminate the middleman.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't want a man, no man in the middle anyway. It's kind of creepy.
As as they said on Penny Arcade, you can't eliminate the middleman. It's all about the middleman. that was a comic strip about half off hand jobs, but that's a. I don't want to go down that tangent, but. You know, something that struck me as interesting about Assault on Precinct 13 that we don't get a lot with a lot of Carpenter's later movies is that this very much satisfies the high concept film test. You know, the idea that the high concept film is, can you describe it in one sentence? And it's like,
oh yeah,
police station under siege.
Yeah, it's like, boom. A short sentence.
Right. You know, and whereas, like, can you really explain Escape from New York in one short sentence like that? No. You know, because it's like, oh, well, Manhattan is a prison, and they got to get somebody out, and it's the president, and he's got 20. No, too many words, yep. You know. Whereas this, it's like, you know, one of my coworkers, he asked me, oh, what are you doing this week? And I said, oh, I've got to watch this movie for my podcast. He goes, oh, what movie? You go, Assault on Precinct 13. He goes, oh, what's that about? And I said, exactly that. Oh, it's about a police station under siege all night. He's like, oh, that sounds cool. You know, you can sell this movie to just about anybody by telling them that.
Yeah.
Even if they know who John Carpenter is.
And it's also a good one to sell to studio executives because it only takes place on, like, a limited amount of sets, you know? I mean, this was a low-budget film. There wasn't much...
$100,000. I thought it was $100,000.
Yeah.
It was?
Yep.
Even the big explosion in it happens off screen, really. It's just a sound effect and some smoke being blown.
Yeah.
But they do, I mean, he does, they just do great things with the little touches, like the final scene just before they blow up all the gang members and they've got the support your local police, you know, sign, and they're fighting backwards, and very much like Night of Living Dead, they're just beating the hell out, like people are putting their hands on their, you see them whack their hands, you see blood start, you know, there were guys with hoses under their hands, and that was pretty intense for you know, a mid-70s movie and just those little touches, you know, added to the grittiness, and the sound design when the initial assault takes place, when they first just, you know, pepper the place with bullets, the sound design of, you know, silencer bullets just pinging everywhere, and you could tell that probably John Carpenter and all his buddies were just like, get the guns, we're just going to shoot up the set now, you know, and they just set the cameras up and just started shooting. And you could tell they had to, there's quite a few jump cuts in there. But boy, it really captures the feeling of the bullets flying all around them. And
yeah, there's the one shot where I think it's like three or four shots in a row hit the stack of papers on the desk.
Yeah.
And start deforming them. And it's like, no, that's, you know, you're right, it's a jump cut, but it's like, that's all they did was just keep start shooting.
Yep.
And however those papers went, that's what they shot. You know, you talk about low budget. Carpenter has been, you know, one of the things he said is that the trick of shooting with a low budget is to shoot as little footage as possible and to extend the scenes for as long as possible. And that, you know, that definitely hits for this one, because this is a very lean, like 91 minutes, I think, or something like that.
Yep.
Very lean little movie. It's like there's not, you know, there's a lot of extended scenes with dialogue and people moving through the set. And it's like, you know, if you only got to set it up once, as long as your actors know their lines, we don't got to, you know, take the time to get everything set back up again. We can keep moving.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the first half hour of it, you know, is before any of the action starts at the precinct. It's all just set. I mean, the scene with the ice cream truck, boy, he takes his time with that, you know, but it's tense, you know. I mean, that car passes by, what, like four or five times before anything finally happens. He really, like, lets it go as long as it can and the scenes of them coming in through the windows and stuff, I mean, those just go on, you know, for it's really funny, because they were like, wait, didn't like 2 minutes go by or something like that? And I'm thinking, no, it was actually probably more like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I love the dub screams of people falling out the windows. They were all IEs. I love IEs. I only hope if I fall to my death that I have enough, you know, presence of mind to yell IE as I go.
The economy in this movie is amazing. I mean, you don't realize, like you say, it's like half an hour before the actual siege begins, but it just moves so quickly. You're like, wow, we're an hour into this already? You know, you don't even realize it.
The characters are all interesting.
And it's very snappy. It's think back again to Howard Hawks, and its dialogue carries a lot of it here, and you know, the whole thing with Napoleon, where, you know, when they're getting them out of the holding tank, oh, you know, doesn't walk as good as he used to, and then he ropes the and it's like, you know, oh, I guess he doesn't walk as good as he used to. It's little things like that that, you know, one thing that I've always noticed about this film is that, when right at the beginning, when Austin's getting into his car and stuff like that, it has that sort of visual banality that a lot of kind of mid-70s movies have.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of looks run-of-the-mill. But then it's little things like that that, you know, have some moments of levity in the movie. And then, of course, once the ice cream truck scene happens, everything flies out the window. So he really kind of takes your expectations to different levels, different directions, and I think that's a good bit of cinematic misdirection.
Yeah, well, once it starts getting dark, once the sun starts going down, it the whole tone of the thing changes. And whoever was the cinematographer in this really captured that twilight lighting. And then after that, the lighting of nighttime, to where it doesn't have that feel in a lot of movies of where either they've shot day for night or they've lit the outside. They've lit stuff in here, but they lit it to look like a dark parking lot with, you know, it doesn't have that artificial look to it. It looks like you're looking out the window. It's got a little bit of the documentary feel of it crossed with cinema, you know, which was sort of that was sort of like really a prominent in that time period, you know, movies like that.
I say 76, that's the same year that Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out, right?
Mm-hmm. Which was lots of handheld camera. This one doesn't have much handheld camera in it, but it's a lot of very static camera, but it's still the shots are still artistically framed and nicely lit, but it always has that feel of being in a real place. You know, when you're in the police station before the lights get cut, it's, you know, it's well lit, it's very bland because everything's packed up. It's just sort of an empty room with fluorescent lights, and it's really so smooth that you might not really even, you know, notice it upon first viewing of it. But yeah, it just keeps getting darker and darker. And then as it gets towards the bitter end, it's darkness and smoke, you know, and until like almost the very end where they all, that beautiful scene where they just, all three of them emerge from the thick smoke, you know, it just sort of slowly clears and they're standing there. That's one of those shots, whenever I see it, it makes me feel like a filmmaker, because I could feel like the guys behind the camera were probably like, roll, and they blew the smoke, and then the smoke cleared, and they were all standing there, and they were probably just all sitting there going, yes, oh, yes. You know, you see it, it's just one of those perfect,
yeah.
You know, not only like the way they look, but the timing with which the smoke clears. It's just a beautiful, beautiful shot.
Actually, I was mistaken. TCM is 2 years earlier, but same kind of idea. You know, the one of the benefits of using that the absolutely cheapest, junkiest film that you can use is that it gives you that pseudo documentary look,
yeah.
Especially shot in a way that enhances that. One of the major things with Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that everyone always remembers it being gorier than it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because of how realistic it looks, you know, the way Hooper shoots it. And again, the same with Assault. It's like Assault on Precinct 13. This is one of the early innovators of the ultra-violent film. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of violence and a lot of gore in this movie. But, you know, this isn't like a modern movie where we'd see a guy's head be literally blown off his shoulders or something like that. Now, this is a lot of kind of old-style squib gags,
yeah.
And stuff.
But
all throw some blood on them and die.
But
know?
The squib gags in it are still pretty. There's something about the silencer shot, the way the silencer shots, make the whole feel of gunfights go in this, because it's something that didn't really come back into the that sort of sound till. Oh, what was that? Saving Private Ryan, when they had the whole sequence of the beach of Normandy, where the gunshots were coming from far away, so all you hear are bullets whizzing and hitting things and stuff. And, you know, what really struck me as being really gory for the time was when they were getting out of the bus and they were going inside, and all of a sudden, you know, you just see everybody get peppered like four or five times in the back. And
right.
A splatter of blood, but there's no bang, bang. It's just thump. It's the thump of a bullet on flesh. And in many ways, it's a lot less gory than a lot of stuff you see today. But, man, you feel it. You know, it's just like, ooh,
yeah,
ow.
It strives to be visceral, and it certainly achieves that.
Yeah, that's what I like. That's what I like, my violence to be visceral. Then it's more like real violence. It's not, you know, there's not as much of that, let's say, entertainment value from as much as.
And really, I think you hit the nail on the head talking about the sound design. I mean, really, any violent film, whether it's an action movie, a horror movie, what have you, to be really, I think, really make an impact on the audience and have the audience really remember it and be affected by that violence, it comes down to the sound design. Like you say, too many, like another great example is Maniac. When, you know, in Maniac, when he jumps on the hood of the car and blasts Tom Savini's head off, that is one of the single goriest shots ever in any movie. But, and it's super, super nasty, but that would have been just another, you know, geek show gag if not for the sound of the shotgun, the sound of the impact of the shot, the sound of his brain splattering all over the car, all of that combined with the visuals burns that into your mind. So if you've seen Maniac, you remember that and it stays with you. It's the same here, like you say, with the silencer shot, because it's not the traditional bang bang, it's just, you know, like a tracer shot, and then it's just people going down. You're like, you know, it's like that situation back in like 2002, 2003 when we had the sniper.
Yes, yes.
You know, and it's that fear that death could be waiting and you have no idea. You couldn't even hear it coming.
It's anonymous. Yeah, it's coming from, it's just coming from God knows where. It's just coming from somewhere else. And yeah, and that's another one of my notes is this was very, it was reminding me of course it's way before the DC sniper, but you know, the scene where they're just driving around and they're putting, you know, homeless people and, you know, the guy's just putting people in his sights, you know, they're just driving around and he's just randomly looking for someone to kill for the sake of killing him, you know? And, yeah, that's a great scene. They don't kill anybody. If it was done today, they probably would just shoot, you know, they would do it like the DC sniper and probably kill somebody or whatever. But yeah, it just shows you that they're just looking to cause chaos. Basically, they've gotten a huge amount of weapons and it also brings to mind a little bit the Warriors too, you know, where all the gangs have united, or, you know, all the different races have united in the, in the search for chaos. Not to sing Kumbaya. I'm ashamed to say I've never seen Maniac, but I'm very, very, very familiar with that gag because one of the first books that I ever, like, memorized, like, and wore out, I'm on my third copy of it, was Bizarro by Tom Savini, which was basically his how to do, you know, gore effects. And basically, it's just basically his memoirs of all the movies he did. And there's a whole chapter just on that head getting blown up in Maniac. And I'm ashamed to say I've never seen the movie. I'm writing it down on my whiteboard right now.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the very multiracial integrated gang. I love all movies that have that because, like, the Warriors has it.
Yeah.
All the Death Wish movies have it. I love any movie where it's like, you know, in contrary to all evidence ever in the history of time, this gang is so violent that they're the worst of every group.
Right.
it's like the Cobra of
exactly. It's, well, that's the thing is that the gang and the way they carry themselves is a completely sort of cinematic conceit in this, you know, and it's a very John Carpenter thing. They're all organized. You also get the impression not only that they're more evil than the normal gang, but they're smarter than the average gang. You know, they've got leadership, and you know they're so organized now that they don't even talk to each other. You know, they're a paramilitary group that you know, silently, you know, surrounds a police station and tactically lays siege to it, you know, cuts off its... I mean, you couldn't get away with that with in cell phone land these days, but, you know, cut the phone wires and cut the electricity and they're screwed if they can't get out of there. So, yeah, and yeah, gangs like that, just the nature of gangs are not like these guys, you know, are not these dead serious guys cutting their hands and pouring in a bowl. There might be stuff like that happening, but it's, you know, yeah, but they make great heavies in the, I mean, the guy who shot the little girl, I mean, he's basically sort of like, give him, put a little jello in his hair and file his teeth down, and he's the guy from Escape from New York who comes in with the message, you know, in the beginning.
I'm glad you mentioned that the Street Thunder are kind of like a paramilitary organization, because the opening scene, you know, I love in the news release we hear is like, oh, that six gang members were killed in a shootout.
Yeah.
Shootout, that was an ambush, if nothing else.
They didn't fire off a single shot. They just sort of, blasted.
That reminded me of the police from They Live, who were hunting down and just gunning down everyone in the resistance camp. And it's like don't move, we're the police, bang, 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 bang. And it's like, you know, can you get more cynical 70s take on the police?
Well, not only that, the police aren't even, you don't even see their faces. They're just arms with pumping shotguns.
Yeah, just ambush a bunch of kids in an alleyway like that.
You'd almost feel bad for the kids, but they all have automatic weapons, I'll remind you.
Well, you know, that's something we see a lot in the horror genre. It's that we're made to feel bad for incredibly bad people.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's like, well, did the police deserve the cholo against them? It's like, well, there's certainly an argument to be made for that. Now, is it, you know, Stoker and Napoleon, are they the ones who had anything to do with this? No, but they're the ones that are going to have to deal with it.
Well, one thing I thought, if they just stayed in their cells, if they just hung out in their cells the whole time, those guys would have come through and said, hey, man, they probably would have let them out of the cells and given them guns, you know? That's what I would have done if I were those. I wouldn't have gone into the jail and shot the guys in the. If I was an organized gang with a philosophy or something, you'd think they'd want to grab these guys. And I also got the feeling that at first I was thinking, Napoleon might be one of those guys who, you know, whatever his crime was, it he either didn't commit it or he was justified in it. But as time went on, I was thinking, oh, no, maybe he did do something really bad, because he seemed pretty resigned to his fate of his death sentence, you know, and at the end he pretty much is just like, all right, you know, he's planning to go off with the police at the end. He's not, you know, there isn't an escape plan in the back of his head or something. So I'm thinking whatever his backstory is, it's probably pretty interesting, but.
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, Napoleon is... I think it's pretty plain that he's the inspiration for Snake Plissken. Whereas, and Plissken's crimes are, you know, not nearly as violent. I mean, Plissken was, you know, in Escape from New York, it's for that robbery job that they did, that they got caught on. Whereas, you know, here it's established that Napoleon has killed at least a couple of people, because, say, why did you kill those men? You know, so he's a killer. You know, whereas Plissken was, you know, a war hero and then, you know, fell on hard times. So I think it's interesting that, you know, he's an even worse dude than Plissken is.
Yeah.
But he's the equal, you know, badass, considering the context, as Plissken is. And so, again, and we talked earlier that this is kind of the prototype for a lot of his later stuff. So definitely Napoleon Wilson, I think, is one of Carpenter's best characters.
He's also a little more of a man. He's still a man of honor, though, you know, in it. Basically, he treats people, the people who treat him with respect, he treats them with a grudging sort of cynical respect, you know, more so after they fought for their lives together. But even the cheesy cop at the beginning, you know, the guy who knocked him out of the chair gets flipped over with the chain, while the other guy, he puts up with him, you know, he'll talk with him on the bus and have a little smart ass rejoinders with him, but But you know, once they get to the jail, you could tell if you know, he treats people with equal, you know, he has an honor system, you know, he has some sort of value system that's pretty strong, you know, because it's so strong that it even sort of brings the other convict who might not be as honorable as him sort of over into going along with his plan. I love that whole scene where they're going to flip a coin and the guy's like, let's not flip a coin because I always lose. And then and it's this really intense scene, and then it ends with them doing one potatoes, two potatoes. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I crack up every time I watch that, Matt.
It's like the last little bit of like real humor in the whole movie before it goes nuts, but it, yeah.
Napoleon also has my favorite line in the entire movie. When they're getting ready for the last big push, when they're making the gang's making their third big push to take the station, and you know, they're setting Lee up where she's going to guard that one corridor, and she goes, I only have two bullets left, do I save for the two of us? And he says, you save for the first two assholes who come out of that bank.
Yeah.
It's that whole, you know, where that 70s cynical anti-hero, but it's like that perfectly encapsulates, you know, this guy who is, again, he's a killer, he's a bad dude, but it's like, no, you take him out, kind of thing.
He's a killer, he's on death row, and he's still going to fight for his life. He's still going to, you know, fight for protect other people.
That's something I could totally see Pliskin saying also.
Yes.
Except he would have said it in like a throaty whisper.
Yes.
Same first two assholes who come out of that vent.
Well, I think the big difference between this guy and Snake Plissken is, I think, just Kurt Russell's just a better actor. That's all. Not that this guy was a bad actor, but Kurt Russell's a great actor, you know. So, you know, that's why he's... I mean, Snake Plissken is actually, you know, I mean, there's just sort of that iconic John Carpenter hero, you know, male lead hero, or even there's even an iconic Carpenter female lead heroine. But, you know, I think the iconicness of them all depends on the charisma of the actor. That's why probably the two greatest Carpenter heroes are Rowdy Roddy Piper and Kurt Russell. You know, those characters are the ones that people just, like, glom right onto, you know. And then Jamie Lee Curtis and Pam Grier being the sort of female Snake Plissken. And I'm really looking forward to when we get to Ghosts of Mars, because I only saw that once a long time ago, and I'm ready to give it another chance.
It'll be good to watch Ghosts of Mars having watched Assault on Precinct 13.
Yes.
Because it's the same movie.
But on Mars!
It's Space Precinct 13.
Well, you know, I mean, going by that rule of summing it up, all you have to do is add the words on Mars to it, and you got that.
Well, you know, over on Star Trek Monthly Monday and Star Wars Monthly Monday, you guys are great about using just the space as an adjective.
Yes.
it's Space Assault on Precinct 13. Yeah.
Or Assault on Space Precinct 13.
Yeah. That's the one.
Oh, my God. We should just do a whole TV series like that, where we just recycle old TV series, you know, every week, and just add space to it, you know? Until we get so bereft of ideas that we have, like, Space Jetsons or something like that, to where it gets...
Yeah, my question was going to be, what if you're redoing a show that's already in space?
Space Star Trek.
It's set in even more space.
If it's okay, how about this? If it was already set in space, we'll set it in inner space. So then everything just gets really small. So it'll be inner space Star Trek. So,
well, I hate to say this, an inner space version of Battlestar Galactica would be pretty neat.
Yeah,
they've got to find the lost, the lost promised land that is the head. We've been floating around this ass nebula for weeks.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, let me see. I pretty much exhausted a lot of my notes.
The only other things I wanted to mention was there are two shots in this which I think, again, are just beautiful examples of Carpenter as a filmmaker. The first is when right after the ice cream man gives the ice cream to the little girl, and then we've got the shot looking in the window, and we see him, and then past him is the driver's side window, and the gang member just steps right into it.
Yeah.
I love that. That always reminds me of when all the punks jump out of the train and escape from New York.
Yeah, so isn't it even accompanied with a similar sort of like,
there's a stinger there. It's just a standard shot, but it's when it's crafted with care, it's very effective. And the other one, of course, is when the cops find the phone company guy.
Yeah.
It's dripping. Such a cliche. It's like, oh, it's raining and it's blood dripping. But again, when it's done correctly, there's a reason why that became a cliche. It's because it works.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I mean, that guy, I mean, they really did a number on that dude, you know, and all he was doing his job, you know. But that's a cholo for you. Oh, that cholo.
Yeah, that could almost be our catchphrase for this show. That's a cholo for you. Hey, maybe we should get t-shirts of that. Yeah, those two cops were very well played too. I liked how one of the cops was, you could just see he was, his radar was up the entire time. And that's what I like in these movies, that like there's always some character who's thinking, you know. It's not just the main characters who are all just who are on the ball, you know. At least if it was a lesser movie, both of those cops would have been Keystone cops, you know. And they probably would have both gotten killed at some point. You're sort of expecting them to get wiped out at some point.
Yeah. Pretty much right after they discover the body. You mm-hmm. expect to hear pop, pop, and that's it. Yeah, I mean, that's something Carpenter tends to avoid. I mean, with the notable exception of the girl from In the Mouth of Madness, there's no ciphers in his movies. But, you know, that was kind of the point, that she was a cipher, but that's, you know.
Yeah, yeah, if you yeah.
That, so do you know that? But, you know, all his characters tend to act like people. You know, they're not stupid because the script says, oh, this guy has to be stupid.
Right, right. Yeah, and I always like that. I always like where, you know, the heroes aren't complete idiots just for the sake of the story, and I'm surprised that it happens so often and is accepted and expected. But that's why I like John Carpenter, is he never, that's why he's who he is.
Yeah, that's why we're doing a film series on him and not, you know, Joe Bloggs or something.
Oh my God, I just got into a, I could have used both of your help to, I don't know how you guys feel on Brian De Palma, but I ended up, somebody was just like, I just saw The Fury and it was the worst movie ever, and followed up by a guy saying, I don't see how there could, I can't think of a worse filmmaker than Brian De Palma. Classic internet statement. And I was like, really? Do you want a list of about 12, you know, I could give you a baker's dozen of them right off the top of my head.
You know, De Palma's problem, and I'm a big De Palma fan. I mean, if you folks go to our forum at forumforgeeks.com and head down to the Two True Freaks section, you know, in my signature, I have a quote from my favorite film of all time, which is Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise.
That's right.
So, and which is my kind of philosophy on life, which is a song is a song. You either dig it or you don't. And, you know, so, but the problem with De Palma, especially relative to someone like Carpenter, you know, Carpenter is, his there's always stuff going on in his films. There's always a lot of stuff going on, like we said. But his films tend to be, you know, still relatable. You know, John Q. Public can watch a John Carpenter film, and they might not get all of it, but they're entertained.
Yes.
When De Palma gets a little artsy, he gets a little weird.
Yeah.
And that turns people off. So.
Well, I can certainly see how someone would see him as an uneven filmmaker, but you know, with someone like him, you know, the thing about, I think the thing that separates him, I think he and Carpenter are very similar in a lot of ways, but yeah, Carpenter has has trumped him consistently by being consistent and by, yeah, never letting really his, like the greatest John Carpenter's ego seems to get in the movies is nowadays they can tack his name at the beginning of it, you know, John Carpenter's whatever. And that's about it. But yeah, I was just like, geez. And these are people who are like, oh, I've been waiting to sort of start arguing with these people, and now I got the right Facebook connection that I can find. They all hang out at the local art theater, so they all think they're film buffs. But that local art theater is one of the greatest places to see trash that you'll ever find in your life, next to a grindhouse on, you know, that used to exist on, you know, in New York City or something. I mean, they show so many, you know, trashy, great, you know, they show a lot of John Carpenter movies there. So I'd think these kids would be a little more informed on what constitute good and bad, especially when they're talking about The Fury. They refuse to put it into context. They're like, I don't know, it's not very exciting. And it's like, come on, it was the first, like, psychic kids on the run, you know, telekinesis on the run movies of a whole string of them, you know?
Psychic on the run. Psychic on
the run. That was a big deal back in the 70s. You had your Escape from Witch Mountain, your Carrie.
Yep.
Your Scanners.
The Fury always like, oh, it's not as good as Carrie. It's like, I'm sorry. You know, it's like, there's a lot of movies I like which are not as good as Carrie. And suddenly now we have to be better than Carrie to be worthy of our consideration.
Yeah, I could have used Scott, too, because they started trashing John Williams' score on the Fury, too, so.
Don't do that. I found there's a couple of things that'll piss Scott off. That's one of them.
A couple of things? There's a couple of... Well, it depends on how fast you want to piss him off.
He got cheesed off at me for saying that, you know, well, Sulu being originally in Xenobotany doesn't really matter. He got pissed at me for that, so. I'm like, dude, just relax. It's okay.
Yeah. It's fun. But now the sad thing is now everybody knows what makes him mad, so.
Oh, my.
Yes, he's a walking target now.
I hate to say
he asked for it.
Because Scott's a really cool dude, and I've really enjoyed recording with him. But if you want to hear what pisses Scott off, just listen to Star Trek Monthly Monday or Star Wars.
Yeah,
get a little sheet and compile a list.
He'll tell you.
Yeah.
Now I've got my buttons though too. You know, I mean the if you apply the theme music to the Enterprise TV show at the right time, it's like slowly I turn step by step, inch by inch. So
I love that fucking song.
That's
love it.
That's my, you know. When well, but what's next?
Well, I think we're gonna. This is 1976. I think we're gonna jump ahead a couple of decades, and we're gonna move back into the 90s, and we're gonna watch John Carpenter's version of Village of the Damned.
A remake.
Yes.
And it's a pretty good one.
Yeah, so starring Christopher Reeve.
Oh, that's right.
And Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill.
That's
Superman,
right.
Superman and Luke Skywalker.
Well, I recently saw Siskel and Ebert's review of it, and it got two thumbs down.
Yeah, big shock.
Yeah. But I remember seeing it, but I don't remember much about it, so I'm sort of looking forward to I might not have been... It was a long time ago, and... I watched it as a... There was, I think, like, almost, like, to the day, Abel Ferrara made a remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And I remember watching the double feature of both of those, of remakes of old classics, and that's about all I remember about it. So neither of them made a huge mark on me. It was a long time ago. Chemicals might have been involved. I don't know. So I'm looking forward to it. We're getting to a lot of the ones that I haven't seen as much as the other ones, and then a few that I've seen a lot of times. So it's actually getting like And pretty soon, there'll be like, another one that's dropped in my memory is the Invisible Man one that I saw, but I don't remember anything about it. I just remember part of it took place in a train.
I've never even seen it, so
it's an experience.
Well, people will be waiting with bated breath for that one. I can tell the enthusiasm that one's. Well,
but Village, I'm looking forward to this. I haven't seen this one in a number of years either, and I like the original.
I like the original too.
Which is Children of the Damned. So I'm looking forward to watching this with my critical eyes. So
I'm a big fan of the book too. The original, the Midwich Cuckolds. Cuckolds? How do you, I don't know.
I think it's just cuckoos.
Cuckoos? It's a cuckoo. But, yeah, it was a really creepy book.
It's a fetish website.
Pardon me?
The Midwich Cuckolds is a fetish website.
Ooh.
We're really, really pushing the envelope here to see.
I was going
to
say, right now, Hair Metal Hero's making some notes.
Yep.
Fire up those browsers, folks. Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
Did you know you can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows? That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled ScottGardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.